Hello, and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. The WTO protests in November 1999 put Seattle on the map. The World Trade Organization had planned a meeting in Seattle to discuss trade agreements for the new millennium. But then tens of thousands of protesters filled the streets. For days, activists overwhelmed the meeting and the city's police force, which responded with tear gas and rubber bullets. The protesters were there to condemn corporate power and the potential impacts of free trade on human rights and the environment. And while the WTO ultimately continued its work, the protest had a big effect on Seattle and the world. It influenced similar movements to come, like Occupy Wall Street, and it impacted how we think and talk about capitalism, globalism, and economic equity. Now, on the 20th anniversary of that protest, Crosscut invited a panel of local leaders to discuss what happened in Seattle in 1999 and what it means to our world today. We're starting this episode with two people who were there during the protests. In part two, we'll be bringing a few more voices into the conversation. John Sellers was one of the lead organizers of the 1999 protests in Seattle. He is co-founder of The Other 98% and board president of the Ruckus Society. An outspoken activist for nearly three decades, he has created scores of direct action campaigns for Greenpeace, the Direct Action Network, the United Steelworkers Union, and many more. Norm Stamper is a retired police officer and now works as a consultant, speaker, and author. He was Seattle's police chief during the protests in 1999. Prior to serving 6 years in Seattle, he was part of the San Diego police force for 28 years. He's now the author of several books, including To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Crosscut editor-at-large Knut Berger moderated the discussion. This conversation was recorded at the KCTS9 studios in Seattle on November 19, 2019, as part of the Crosscut Talks Live series.
Well, welcome. WTO demonstrations were a big deal in Seattle. When we say WTO, it means the World Trade Organization, but in Seattle, it means the protests that happened 20 years ago this month. And I don't think I've ever felt older than when I was writing a column a short while ago, and I happened to mention the WTO protests, and the editor put in a comment, "What's that? Explain." I wanted just to briefly set up what was happening 20 years ago, and then we'll hear from people who were key players in what happened back then. But imagine it was the end of November, first week of December. Promoters of having the World Trade Organization have their summit meeting, international summit meeting here in Seattle. They thought this would be a showcase. Seattle would have arrived as a world-class city. This would show our importance in trade, particularly trade with the Pacific Rim. They were very excited to have the delegations here and to show off. Labor, environmentalists, and others saw it as a chance to make a statement against corporate globalization in general. And there were others here, too, wanting to make that statement. It began as a kind of celebration, a sort of Woodstock of protest with people from all over the country and the world who came. And then it turned into what we call the Battle of Seattle, or the Battle in Seattle. tear gas, rubber pellets, property damage, downtown businesses were disrupted. There's a disagreement on the number of people who participated in the protest, but it's somewhere between 40 and 60, maybe even 70,000 people, if you can imagine the streets of Seattle. It was the largest civic disruption since the general strike of 1919, which is 100 years old this year. In 1999, you can just kind of imagine, here it is, a rainy November, but everything felt kind of portentous. The new millennium was coming up. Seattle was changing and growing, feeling, I think, idealistic, yet also uncomfortable with the burgeoning of tech and what the new millennium was going to mean. We're all worried about Y2K. Who remembers Y2K? It's going to be a total global computer collapse. Everything seemed very important. I was editor of Seattle Weekly at the time, and one of my reporters who covered business came to me and said, hey, I just read this little item in the Wall Street Journal. And this is a year before, this is I think in January of 1999. He said that labor groups have moved organizers to Seattle and are planning a massive protest against the WTO, and they're estimating they're going to bring in thousands of union members to protest. He said, that sounds kind of big, you know. I decided we needed to cover this as part of what we did at the Weekly. We covered the impending WTO off and on for a full year before it actually occurred. We sent writers down to Eugene to talk to anarchists. We talked to people in trade. We covered all aspects of it. But one of the things we said is this is going to be a really big deal. We were owned by the Village Voice at that time. And my overseer at the Village Voice came to me and said, Skip, I think you're going overboard on this WTO thing. And I said, no, I'm not. It's going to be a really big deal. Journalistically, we have to cover it. I don't think it's being covered by the mainstream press very well, so we're going to do it. We were prepared on November 30th. My staff was in the streets. We had photographers everywhere. We had guys inside the WTO summit. We had people outside. We had people at all the various places. I happened to station myself at 6th and Union. And those of you who know about WTO know about 6th and Union. This was the place when police decided to clear an intersection of entrenched protesters, and all hell broke loose. I was standing there with a reporter from Mexico City, and when the pepper spray and the rubber pellets began ricocheting through the crowd, a sound I will never forget. When you heard those pellets hit people, you knew you never wanted to be hit by one of those things. The reporter from Mexico City turned to me and said, this is crazy. And we fled. We fled, our eyes filled with pepper gas, and I think tear gas, pepper grass, somebody can explain the difference, but it hurts. We ended up covering the WTO for 2 years, so we covered the demonstrations in the year build up to them. We covered the demonstrations and we wrote about it for at least a year after because of all the after action reports. It was a kind of a public scandal in Seattle. People wanted to know who was responsible for this. And people on all sides wanted to know. The business community wanted to know how come their Christmas shopping had been disrupted by all these protesters shutting down downtown Seattle. Protesters were upset with the police response. The trade people were upset that we had been embarrassed internationally. And Seattle became one of those terms that you heard people in other cities say, which is, we don't want another Seattle. Now, 20 years later, we have the virtue of some perspective, and I hope that we'll be able to get that from our panelists tonight. And before we do, I thought we would take a look at a film clip. And this is from Jill Friedberg, who made a movie called This Is What Democracy Looks Like. And take a look.
No power like the power of the people, because the power of the people today because we see the oppressed people of the South and the oppressed people of the North now together here saying, down with U.S. imperialism.
From all over, you got labor, you got environmentalists, you got teachers, you've got children, you've got coalitions between people of color and you know, mainstream white Americans. You've got middle class, you got working poor, you got poor, you got everybody out here because this hurts people. This is bad for people. It's bad for our jobs here. It's bad for the people over there.
It's about their future being traded off by corporations who frankly don't give a shit what happens to them. That's what it's about. That's what people are fed up with it. They understand it.
Ladies and gentlemen, a little bit of information. We are successfully blocking out delegates.
All right. Our guests, our first guests, are guys who were on opposite sides of the barricades during WTO. First, like to introduce, come on up, Norm Stamper. Spent 34 years in law enforcement, including six as Seattle's chief of police from 1994. Next, I'd like to introduce John Sellers. John is executive director and co-founder of Other 98, co-founder of the Ruckus Society. Leading up to the WTO demonstrations, he met with members of nearly every organization who were later present in the organized protests. Mother Jones Magazine has described John Sellers as a career thorn in the side of the establishment. John, I want to go to you first. I want to know from what you think when you see that film as the demonstrators. What were you thinking? What were you planning?
Thanks for having me. I think that I can only speak for myself. We were trying to confront the ascendance of global corporate power that was embodied by the WTO. For me and for my friends at the Ruckus Society, it was always bigger than trade. It was about unchecked corporate power and the rise of unchecked corporate power and how undemocratic that entity is. And we wanted to start a conversation in the United States, in the belly of the beast, where so many of these corporations call home, about capitalism, and we wanted to make it okay to critique capitalism and question whether unchecked capitalism is good for democracy. And I think that we were able to start a really important conversation. We were well aware that we were carrying on and, you know, walking in the footsteps of so many movements that have come before us, so many American movements, the civil rights movement, the suffrage movement, but also global movements. And, you know, we were, I think, really inspired by the Zapatistas and their confrontation, their largely peaceful confrontation with corporate power. And I think we just wanted to show the rest of the world that there was real resistance here in the United States to what was happening with unchecked globalization being a race to the bottom across the entire planet.
Would you have taken the actions that you did in any city in America where this conference would have taken place, or was there something particular about Seattle that made it an inviting environment?
Well, I think the fact that they chose Seattle was an incredibly, it was a huge error that they made strategically by choosing Seattle. So it opened up a wealth of possibilities for us, because at that time, there was no, you know, epicenter in North America that was more radical than Seattle. You know, we had a very radical forest movement that had quite a lot of direct action going on. You know, it was just kind of the center of radical political thought and action in North America. And when we saw the WTO site itself here, we knew that it created all kinds of opportunities for us and other people to organize a huge nonviolent direct action, the likes of which America hadn't seen in a long time.
And just to be clear, one of the things that happened was the effort was to shut down the conference, at least for a day. Is that right?
Yeah, that was our stated intent. And, you know, I think we had a very strong strategic plan to be able to do that, but we were also really surprised by how close the Seattle Police Department let us in. You know, we had 13 clusters of affinity groups that were all, you know, operating autonomously, and they were all prepared to block their part of the perimeter, regardless of how far out the Seattle Police Department and law enforcement pushed that perimeter. But when we marched out there in the morning and we saw that the perimeter was right up against the conference itself, we knew that we were going to have our way with them for at least a few hours. And you know, I think we had probably about 5,000 people that had really trained and prepared for the actions, coming in infinity groups that were autonomous and planned and prepared, and then another 5,000 people joined them spontaneously. So I think the true perimeter, the true action around the convention center until Labor busted through its marshals and reinforced us was about 10,000 people. And it was an incredible moment. You know, there were literally, I remember the Teamsters pulled up with this huge semi-trailer with a giant sound system in it and just started blasting, dancing in the streets. And there were Teamsters and turtles, you know, square dancing and throwing each other around, and you called it a kind of a Woodstock. It was one of the best protest parties I've ever been to for a couple of hours, and you know, just 13 of the most amazing, beautifully, you know, thought of and beautifully pulled off actions that I've ever seen.
Well, that brings us to Norm. And you were police chief. You were in charge of keeping order during this event. What were you expecting?
Not what we got. very brief background. I was raised in San Diego, spent the first 28 years of my 34-year cop career in the San Diego Police Department. Some people have forgotten, many people did not know, that San Diego was Seattle's closest competition to be named the host city for the World Trade Organization. So I grew up in that cop culture, During an era of campus unrest and anti-war demonstrations, we're talking Vietnam era, civil rights insurrections, a lot of protests on the streets, even in that, or perhaps especially in that conservative city. So then I get to Seattle, and I had seen my police department at work on protests of a variety of purposes and compositions and so forth over the 6 years that I was here. I was told throughout the planning process and the 11,000 hours of training, some people say, you didn't even train your officers. Well, we did, to the tune of 11,000 hours for our patrol forces. We did invoke mutual aid. We did plan. We did prepare. We just did a terrible job of it. We did not do enough planning, enough preparation, and certainly we didn't do enough contingency planning. But the idea, typical for any kind of police protest relations, was to enable the host group, in this case the World Trade Organization, actually Port Authority, the city of Seattle, and of course the WTO, to hold their ministerial conference, to create opportunities for anti-globalization, anti-multinational corporation protesters to assemble and to express themselves freely on the streets of Seattle, which led to this conclusion that we needed to allow protesters, unlike in cities like Washington, D.C. or New York, to get up close, to get up close to their target, which of course was the convention center and surrounding venues that were associated with WTO. The job of the police under these circumstances is to be steadfastly neutral. We are not for or against this group or that group. We are for public order. We are for public safety. We are against violence. We are against destruction of property. And we believed, I will confess here and now, I believed that we had it covered. And I don't believe I've ever been more wrong looking back on that experience than I was when I agreed with my assistant chief, who said, Norm, we got this thing. I was absolutely convinced that we would get through that entire week with a skirmish here, a skirmish there, maybe an arrest here, an arrest there, but we would not see anything of the order that we did see. I will, in my opening remarks, I guess, by saying that on Tuesday morning of that week, in 30 forevermore, we used chemical agents, a euphemism for tear gas, against nonviolent, indeed non-threatening fellow Americans who had assembled at 6th and Union and took a seat in the intersection. And for some ungodly reason, we figured we need this intersection. We can't allow this to happen. And so a declaration of an unlawful assembly was declared. We warned and warned and warned, and in fact said we will use chemical agents if necessary, if you don't get up and clear this intersection. Our rationale, by the way, the cop and me supporting this, was that if somebody is bleeding out a block or two on the other side of that demonstration, we could not get an aid car, couldn't get a fire engine, couldn't get a police car through to that person in need. In point of fact, we could have gone out of our way to make our way around that protest. But we also, I think, got scared. We had, because of a very masterful plan from people like John, contingents of additional demonstrators descending on the same area. And that was the point at which, having promised Direct Action Network that we would be making some choreographed arrests, an opportunity for them to engage in civil disobedience, for us to make arrests under the watchful eyes of the TV cameras, and we had to call that off. We had to, in effect, renege on our promise because we could not have adequately policed it. And I'm going too long, so I'll stop there.
One of my indelible images prior to WTO was the anarchist marching band, this was maybe a couple weeks before, practicing under the, it wasn't the Alaskan Way Viaduct, but it was down in the industrial area. My wife and I were driving around. And I thought, what, anarchists are practicing. this was, and I thought, boy, they're really getting organized. But it never occurred to me that they would play such a pivotal role in both changing some of the nature of the protest and also eliciting a response that ended up getting, I think, maybe an outsized amount of publicity. And John, I wonder what you think about the black blocs and the anarchist property destruction, et cetera, that occurred during, what's your view of that? Do you see it differently?
It's a complex question. My main view of it is that they, with the help of the corporate media and the help of Fox News, stole the entire narrative of everything that we had worked for. You know, we wanted to show a massive, nonviolent, militant refusal and an intervention with the WTO. And we had done that successfully, and we had shut the meeting down successfully, the most powerful, important corporate pep rally that had ever been on Earth. And then 25 or 30 angry, mostly boys in black came out and started beating up on corporate property. And I sailed with Greenpeace. I got to cut a drift net in the Mediterranean. You know, I've destroyed corporate property before, but it was understood as a political action, and it was one of the most nonviolent things I've ever done. When they started beating up, smashing McDonald's and smashing Starbucks and smashing Nike Town, I think they endangered a lot of people that didn't come out there to have a fight with the cops. And I think that the narrative has been stolen from us, you know, in the years since Seattle, because most people understand it as a riot, that the protesters showed up and created a riot, and the Seattle Police Department had to come and defend Seattle from this riot. And so I have a lot of misgivings about, you know, if they wanted to smash up at McDonald's. You know, I was having beers a couple nights during the WTO with José Bové, this famous French farmer who, when the U.S. sanctioned France for some trade violations, and they decided to slap a tariff on expensive French cheeses. And so this farmer, José Bové, with some of his friends, went to a McDonald's that they were building in France with their tractors, and they tore the McDonald's down with their tractors. And they became folk legends in France, and the president of France had to come to the jail where they got locked up and say, let them go, because there's going to be riots outside if you don't let them go. And, you know, so that was understood as a political act, and it didn't endanger anyone. And they stayed there, and they, you know, they said, yes, we destroyed this McDonald's, arrest us. Like, we, you know, they took responsibility for their actions. You know, I think with the, when the Black Bloc shows up, you know, and uses 10,000 people as cover to do their action, and then endangers those 10,000 people in the process of their action, I have a problem with that.
I just want to follow up quickly. You're living in Portland now. You were living in Seattle, or Vashon Island. You're living in Portland now. And what do you think about the anti-fascist actions down there in response to the Proud Boys and things like that? Is that something that you keep an eye on, and what do you think about that?
Yeah, I definitely keep an eye on it. You know, I have kids. I have two 15-year-olds that live in Portland with me and my wife. And, you know, I get concerned that we're this front line, this, you know, sort of skirmish line between the Proud Boys and the Nazis that seem to mostly live over in Vancouver, Washington. On the Washington side, they come into the city to fight with the anarchists. And it's something that I track, and, you know, I'm you know, fiercely anti-fascist, but I just don't think that we're going to beat Nazis by getting into, you know, physical altercations with them. I think it actually gives them huge recruitment opportunities every time they get into a fight, and they grow their numbers. And so I just, you know, morally, I don't have a problem with punching Nazis. I just don't think it's a very strategic thing to do.
Norm, I want to ask you what lessons you took away from your experience in Seattle, but also a little more broadly, what lessons did the police take away from WTO?
Well, I can give you the lessons that I've learned, but I need to distinguish between my picture of how policing such demonstrations and protests should go against the vast majority of my former colleagues, because we do not see eye to eye on this. I believe that once it is understood that a particular organization that generates any kind of controversy from whatever perspectives is coming to town, that the planning effort, the preparation, the training, and indeed the co-policing should be a joint enterprise between the police and those who are protesting. Now, obviously, that can lead some to say, well, you're talking about co-opting the protesters. That's not at all what I would envision. What I envision is a true co-planning, co-preparation, co-policing enterprise that allows the beautiful scenes that we saw from this clip. What we didn't see, of course, was what happened when things went south, a direct result of, in my view, of police provocation that I presided over and that I supported for 5 years into my retirement. It wasn't until on book tour and encountering lots and lots of protesters who were on the streets of Seattle and hearing from them what their experience was that I was forced to confront my own views, my own values, and frankly, my own traditions. It was a very traditional police response to what happened in Seattle. And it was a time clearly for a non-traditional response. And I will regret to the grave the fact that I did not veto the decision to use chemical agents. That was my job, and I fell down in that regard. I'll also tell you a little personal story. I think Paul Schell took a whole lot of criticism that he did not deserve, that does, in fact, belong on my shoulders. He was, I think, genuinely interested in creating or helping to facilitate, I should say, it's not his job to create it, but to facilitate the conversation that we did not want to see blemished by the black bloc. And it was a horrible, I think, outcome, agreeing completely with what John is saying, what happened during the Battle of Seattle. But I guess the lessons learned are, number one, Schell disagreed with me. May he rest in peace. But he had words with me after I had told him that I was resigning, retiring early. And he said, you've got to stop saying that Seattle was too small to host WTO. I firmly believed then, I now believe even more, that it was not a wise decision for the United States, and Bill Clinton ultimately made the decision about where WTO ministerial conference was going to be held, on the streets of a city of, at that time, maybe 550,000, 560,000 people, with roughly 900 available Seattle police officers, plus an additional several hundred through mutual aid and satellite cities. And not to speak out of school, I personally approached the police chief in Tacoma and said, we need your help, in advance of WTO. And he said, well, if things go south on you, just give us a call and we'll be there. That was not what I expected or wanted to hear from that chief. But I'm getting personal here, aren't I? I apologize for that. I think lesson one is that if you're looking at something on as massive as a scale that we knew would be happening here, you may want to think about cities that can put lines of police officers at intersections. one intersection after another, because we were regularly, systematically, and brilliantly outflanked by ruckus and forces of anti-globalization during that entire week. So that sounds like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. We screwed up, and the error was mine, and it was a big, big mistake, and that was on the morning of N30. But we are also too small a city, I think, for something like WTO.
That's the end of part one. For part two, Crosscut invited two more voices to the stage. Now the focus turns to the broader impacts of the WTO protest, how it influenced activists and movements for years afterward. The panelists also discussed global trade policy, the role of police during mass protests, politics, and, of course, capitalism. Nikita Oliver is a Seattle-based creative, community organizer, abolitionist, educator, and attorney. She teaches, advocates, writes, and speaks in a wide range of venues. In 2017, she ran for mayor of Seattle as the first political candidate of the Seattle People's Party. She currently organizes with the Seattle People's Party, as well as No New Youth Jail. Norwell Kokiar is executive director of the Washington State China Relations Council. He has more than 25 years of experience conducting business in Asia, including as the chairman and president of Cargill in China, and as country manager for Cargill in Japan and Korea. He also served 2 years as chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. Okay, on with the show.
All right, we're going to get started with phase two of our panel. Nikita, I want to start with you. You did not participate in WTO, but you felt some of its influence in activism and organizing since then, and I wonder if you could tell us what kinds of things you've seen and learned.
Yeah, so I consider myself a young activist and organizer, deeply inspired by what happened at WTO, also who's been trained by folks who trained for WTO, so having learned many of those tactics. And so there's a few ways I've seen WTO influence activism in Seattle. The first is just the strategy used to shut down downtown, knowing that having intersections and affinity groups and having a coordinated effort, but that is planned by multiple people, can actually deeply impact events, but also deeply impacts business. And understanding that if we're going to get a change in a capitalist society, if we're going to get a change in a society that is essentially a corporatocracy, that we have to put a dent in the pockets of corporations. Also, our experience with the police has been deeply impacted by WTO. So the tactics that I have watched in videos of WTO are the same tactics that they've used against us. And primarily during protests like Black Lives Matter protest or May Day protest, where they line up and they yell move, where they spray mace into the air or use tear gas as a way of trying to dispel us. We also learned from WTO that by attaching ourselves to each other, building barricades, creates a situation that buys us time and allows us to stay in a place. But the thing that I take most from that, what I heard Norm talking about, is this idea that protesters and police should be in conversation. And I actually take great issue with that. We are protesting an imperialist state. So why would we work with the militarized police force of that state? And that's actually something that we've taken forward from WTO protests, is that we can have peaceful protests, we can have effective protests, but it does not work when we attempt to partner in any way with the police. They are actually a force that's been set up to protect property and to protect corporations. And in many ways, they are in opposition to us using our First Amendment rights to effectuate change.
Have you seen a downside of that, or is there mostly an upside to that separation?
I see that separation is essential, especially when you're thinking something like Black Lives Matter or even May Day, where you're protesting imperialism. To work with the militarized force of the state is to undercut the movement that you're trying to push forward. I also think what WTO has shown, and also the responses to Black Lives Matter protests, is the state and police's commitment to property over people. And that has continued forward now, still in Seattle, despite the changes that SPD has said they've made, both in relation to the criticism of WTO and the consent decree.
Norwell, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the state of trade. One of my theses is that one of the sort of shadow elements at the WTO demonstrations was the presence of the far right. Pat Buchanan came he didn't participate in the demonstrations, but Pat Buchanan was here. He was running for president on the Reform Party ticket. He'd beaten out a guy named Donald Trump for the nomination. And he was against WTO, and there were other conservatives who were here who were kind of cheering on the protesters even while they didn't like those damn hippies. But they saw an opportunity to recruit blue-collar union people, Teamsters. They opposed the internationalism of WTO, and they believed in extreme nationalism and anti-immigration, that kind of thing, largely. And it strikes me that if you look at our current president and look at the current state of trade, they kind of won WTO. I mean, they're in power, and you know the sort of liberal free trade neoliberal Clinton types in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are on the outs. You are China is where a lot of this is happening. I wonder if you could talk about what you've experienced and what you see as far as where we are on trade itself.
Sure. Okay, I'd be glad to. First of all, I wasn't here in 99. I've spent most of my last 35 years in Asia. I moved to Seattle about 2 years ago, new to the city, so it's fun to get to know people and learn a little bit about the history. Also, so I'm not totally out of sync. I was in Hong Kong last week, and I was tear gassed. I was not protesting, but I ran into it by accident, so I can I guess I understand a little bit. I actually lived in South Korea actually in the 80s too, and actually going home from work at night, you kind of sniff the air and said, the tear gas is to the left, I'll go home to the right. Those were student riots back then. So I'm quite familiar with these types of protests. I would just say that of my 35 years of living in Asia, I've seen tremendous change in those countries with the opportunity and the fact that people have been raised out of poverty. I think what's happened in this country is the social security net is not secure enough. I think with globalization, the corporations and the governments haven't done enough for training of the workers. And so quite frankly, when you move a factory from Lordstown, Ohio to China or someplace else, and you don't do anything for the workers, you're going to have the kind of unhappiness, the malcontent, the issues that we've had today. So Trump has tapped into that. And I think, quite frankly, there's a lot of people out there that have suffered from global trade. And the United States has not done a very good job. There are many other countries, too, have not done a very good job of addressing it. Now, do I say that we should bring back all these factories to America? You're not going to bring back, as we saw in those pictures, you're not going to bring back yarn spinning and that kind of stuff. The truth is it's moving out of China now because China is too expensive for those kind of industries. It's going to Bangladesh and Cambodia and other places. So I certainly believe in global trade. I think it's a way to raise people's incomes. It's to raise their possibilities. Look at how international this city is today and how an exciting place it is to be because, A, the immigrants and the global trade. So I think the system should work, but there are downsides to it. I guess I'd say capitalism overall works, but there are certainly areas where it needs attention. and people need to understand that it's not just the shareholders, it's the stakeholders that need to be involved. So right now, Trump has the ear of people that have been impacted negatively by globalization, but I think we can make it work if you get the right leaders in. And just go back to Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong today, it's the same thing. The political leaders are nowhere to be seen. No one's addressing the problem. And I think maybe that's what actually happened in 99, is you didn't have people that were, and again, I was not here, but addressing what are the real issues with globalization.
Yeah. John, I want to bring you in because we had a chat on the phone a while ago when I asked you about the Pat Buchanan, Donald Trump seizure of trade policy and opportunity, and you had some thoughts about how that happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the Democrats really lost their way and gave Trump this opportunity. You look at Obama and Hillary campaigning for free trade agreements in the Midwest during the election, campaigning on a free trade platform. You know, the Democrats and the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party that's embodied by the Clintons, you know, embraced free trade, embraced corporate globalization, and embraced this, you know, kind of corporate race to the bottom across the planet looking for cheaper and cheaper labor. And so they set the stage for a populist like Trump to come to power. You know, we're in this populist moment, and you know, I never imagined that in my lifetime there would be an ascendant democratic socialist wing of the Democratic Party that would also be, you know, a very progressive force. And, you know, I think it takes a progressive to beat a populist to beat a populist. And if we had managed to nominate Bernie, I think he would have wiped the floor with Trump on trade.
Norwell, what do you think of that? What do you think of the Sanders-Warren wing?
Well, quite frankly, I'm in favor of a number of things that, say, Warren is proposing. Actually, Bernie, too, on particularly on social issues. I think on the corporate issues, she won't be able to get past what she's proposing, but the fact that she's proposing is creating the discussion, and I think that discussion really needs to take place in America. I will say the thing, so I was gone 35 years, I guess, over in Asia, and the thing I noticed most coming back to America this time was the inequalities. I guess maybe when I was younger I didn't pick them up, but I left America in the early 80s, and I see inequality today as a much bigger issue than I did when I left. So obviously, some of the ideas that Bernie and Warren have need to be examined closely. Obviously, the most radical ones I don't think will ever get through Congress, but the discussion needs to take place. I think it does.
Nikita, you want bigger change, I think. Can you talk a little bit about Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and also what you see going on in Seattle and what needs to happen?
Well, we could talk about that for hours. You know, the first thing I think about when it comes to Bernie and Elizabeth Warren is, well, politically they might be a change. When we talk about inequities, it's still a huge racial inequity that continues to get perpetuated by who gets to be in power or decision-making positions in this country continues to be white folks with some amount of economic privilege. I would also say that from that discussion, there is a huge environmental discussion missing. Now, I think people are paying nod to things like the Green New Deal, but part of the problem with capitalism and part of what I think WTO was trying to bring to the surface was the importance of intersectional movements, which include the environment as a stakeholder in the whole ecology of the world that we live in. Capitalism's number one goal is to eat up as much as it can, which includes our environment, until we can no longer sustain. And so when I'm thinking about more radical shifts, it is a shift to what I think we'll talk about later is a decolonized way of thinking about property and resource and humanity as a part of a whole ecology of the planet, that we have to learn to live more sustainably. We cannot eat more than what the planet can produce. And so seen ways in which our racial justice agendas, our environmental justice agendas, our economic justice agendas, dealing with mass incarceration, these are not single issue fights. They're actually intersectional fights that have to be aligned in a single political movement. And it's not enough to have a democratic socialist getting to talk about the issues on the national stage. We actually need a huge movement for change. Otherwise, in 10 years, this planet is not going to be sustainable.
John, again, Chi activism. I wonder if you can talk about, from an environmental standpoint, some of the things you didn't. Did you not just organize a protest in Portland related to pipeline?
Yeah, I think Nikita hits a really great point that the capitalism is at odds with the planet and the carrying capacity of the planet, and no corporate sector on Earth is as nefarious as the oil and gas sector. I mean, they've been running the planet for hundreds of years now, creating havoc, waging wars for oil and resources. And so every chance that I get, I like to try to stop them from creating new infrastructure. And right now, in a state that has a governor that ran on being the most green candidate, the climate guy up there on the stage of all the presidential candidates, we are bringing the dirtiest pipeline on Earth from India, where it's manufactured, into the Port of Vancouver, where we're unloading it with Washington labor, and we're shipping it on Washington rail up to British Columbia, where Justin Trudeau is building the dirtiest pipeline on the planet from the tar sands to the coast of British Columbia. It'll increase tanker traffic in the Salish Sea by 700%, and it'll be the most dangerous crude that we've ever transported in really fragile waters. It, in many ways, a death blow to the remaining orca population and probably the salmon as well, because it's not a matter of if it will spill, but when it will spill. And I just think, why in the world is Washington helping Canada build the world's last dirtiest pipeline? I don't understand it. And not from, how can we let this governor, Inslee, call himself the greenest guy out there while he's aiding and abetting this atrocity for the First Nations of Canada and for everyone that's counting on a safe climate.
Norm, I wanted to go back to policing a little bit, because you have also written quite a bit about how to improve or reform policing and police culture. And I'm wondering if you could talk about just quickly about what could they be doing better? I mean, beyond simple tactics, what you've been inside that brotherhood, and is there any hope of police actually doing what you would like?
Well, frankly, if I thought there were no hope, I would just plain shut up and I would stop writing. So I have to believe that there is hope. And the radical reform of law enforcement that I seek has very few advocates. I believe the police in America belong to the people, not the other way around. The police in America have an obligation to open the doors of policymaking and program development and crisis management and protest and crowd management and so on and so forth in a way that is truly radical. That if we, in fact, want to see any kind of improvement in community police relations, if we want to honor Black Lives Matter and stop killing young black children, if we want to create the kind of community police relationship that is an authentic partnership, the police have got to open the doors and see things differently. But I really do believe that it's going to come from the outside, not from the inside. and that what's necessary is for citizens, and I use that term in a very narrowly defined way, but citizens to essentially say to the police, you are ours, you belong to the people. And for those police officers who show up at a scene and essentially communicate verbally and non-verbally, I'm the cops and you're not, I'm in charge here, is anti-democratic. In language that I think appeals to some police officers, it's un-American. And so I think it's just vital that we look at radical reform of the institution. And I've written extensively about how that might be accomplished, but I'm not gaining a whole lot of traction.
Nikita, what about you?
I think that so long as the role of police is to protect property or to crowd manage residents that are rising up against fascism and imperialism, they stand on the side of the imperialist. And my experience around police reform as it relates to Black Lives Matter is most officers think that we are the problem. There is an inherent white supremacy in the police force. There is inherent patriarchy and sexism, and there is a buy-in to capitalism. The biggest barrier to quote-unquote police reform is the police union, whose number one job is to continue to protect the institution of policing as the militarized force of the state. So until officers are willing to, for example, at a protest like WTO, instead of protecting the property and standing on the side of the state telling protesters to move, actually turn and guard protesters, turn and sit with protesters, not mace or tear gas protesters, and in fact go against whatever command they're being given by the imperialist state, there is no reforming the police state. There is dismantling it.
I'm curious if, just imagining now, what kind, if you could organize a WTO scale protest somewhere about something, what would it be?
This is a great question. Yeah, I mean, I think all of our movements are intersectional. I think the environment and the leadership of Native and Indigenous communities rising up to protect the environment from corporations is something that protects all of us. The last large-scale protest I participated in was at Standing Rock. And I want to see that scale of protest at an epicenter of economics, where we actually put a dent in the financial pocket of those who profit off of the backs and the lives of our communities, and see that be sustained. The number one, while WTO was successful in the moment, what it was not successful at was a sustained, effective protest against capitalism that continued to put the dent in the wallet, that continued to cause strife or the thorn in the side. I think we tried with Occupy, but the question is, how do we sustain that kind of long-term protest that does that? So I don't know if it's one targeted place. I think the other, I'll finish with this. I think the other thing that gets overlooked with WTO was it wasn't just happening in Seattle. It was happening in ports all across the United States, port cities across the United States. It was happening all over the globe that people were shutting things down, that people were, they were breaking property, owning it for the purpose of showing, like, we will come for you. I think in the United States, we're too comfortable. We're not ready yet to say we will come for you.
Interesting. Norwell, what do you think of that? What's your response? You have a very different background.
Yeah, right. I'm the capitalist in the room, so to speak. Quite frankly, I guess I'd say Nikita, and I've, tonight's the first night I've met Nikita, is what alternative system really do we have? I think what I'm saying is I think the capitalist system overall is the probably the best system to improve people's lives, but it's got a lot of problems. And it certainly needs, as I said earlier, to me, it needs lots of attention, and it needs government intervention, obviously, to make sure that that everyone participates. I mean, there's more talk today, and it's probably more talk by the big corporations that they're beginning to think about more than just their shareholders, you know, responsible and sorts of. And some of it's whitewash. Some of it, hopefully, we hope is true. But I've just, as I said, I've seen from my lifetime what the improvements of lives of people around the world. Again, the millions of people have been raised out of poverty, et cetera, in other countries around the world. The issue is the United States has had a really good, from an economic point of view, a really good run. And we've enjoyed a very nice life. And quite frankly, we're not going to go, as I said earlier, we're not going to go back to low-wage jobs. So what we need to do is continue to innovate. We need to take our, we need to invest in R&D. We need to invest in infrastructure. We need a lot of things to do to make the country to continue to grow and then to spread the wealth better.
Do you mind if I respond?
Yes, please do.
I think, you know, when it comes to capitalism, it was able to take hold on the back of imperialism and white supremacy. It did so by genociding not just the native populations of Turtle Island, I should say, and using black folks from Africa as stolen property and capital. But it continues to do so on the backs of the global South without any acknowledgement of that. That's why there are cities all over the world right now that are uprising because of the impacts of capitalism. It's also done so with United States meddling in other places' elections when they attempt to break free from the capitalist system. And then you see it blatantly here in Seattle where corporatocracy has made an attempt to buy our elections when socialist candidates are getting the opportunity to push forward a new, more humanistic, more environmentally sound agenda. And so I think capitalism, the problem with it is, especially those of us who have lived in places like the United States on Turtle Island, is that we have benefited so greatly from it, but never experienced its greatest ills that we think is the best thing that could exist. I think there are indigenous ways of caring for the planet and serving community that if we were more open to them and willing to actually allow indigenous folks to lead at the forefront of many of our movements and our governments, we could transform our economic system to be one that cares for both the planet and humanity. We're not open to it because there are wealthy folks who stand to lose a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now they're handing me a technical device which I may destroy within mere moments. I have that capacity inadvertently. And these are some questions that have been submitted by the audience. We have a few minutes to go into that. There are a number of questions here which I think are on basically on the topic of the fear of the Seattle police that was generated during WTO and the fear displayed by police today. Norm, do you want to tackle that? The police go into the community with a kind of fear. At least that's I perceive that.
It is my experience.
Yeah.
Not just in two major city police departments, but in doing consulting and expert witness work around the country, that police officers engaged in patterns of violence are very often scared to death because fear is not a socially acceptable emotion within the cop culture. They compensate and they find ways to abuse the very people they've been hired to protect and serve. And over and over and over, I have conducting personnel investigations and firing police officers and so forth, reinforce that conclusion that a whole lot of cops in this country are scared to death and are unable and unwilling to confront that fear. I think it's particularly true that white cops are afraid of black people in general, and black men in particular, and the bigger and the darker the black man, the greater the fear. That's not something that police officers will talk about. In fact, they will just aggressively resist the notion that they're afraid at all. And oftentimes, they're not feeling consciously fear. They're feeling anger. And they're feeling, you know, this sense of having had their authority questioned, that they're going to, in fact, exact street justice. And I think if we really want to get smart about police reform, we've got to acknowledge the role of fear in policing. Many people are afraid of the police for a good reason. And many police officers are afraid of the communities they serve for a very poor reason.
John, here's a question that I think you can answer. Was WTO as fun as it looked in the video?
Yeah, it was. I got to the day before N30, N29, I got to hang a giant banner out over the city that had two one-way street signs pointing in opposite directions. One said WTO, the other said democracy. They're pointing like this and like that. And, you know, I got into this action at the last minute. One of the climbers pulled out, and so I jumped into this action and climbed this big crane and rappelled off it and hung this big banner, and it was, you know, it was awesome, really fun action. And I got arrested, we had a deal with this really cool bail bondswoman. You know, I gave her the Ruckus credit card, and she would just bail out anybody who I asked her to bail out. And so we bailed out. I couldn't believe they let us out of jail the night before the WTO. I was like, they had us, and they let us out of jail. And there was this big rally at the Key Arena, and we went in there with a giant monkey wrench and held it up, and, you know, and the steel workers went, and we left the banner up on the arm of the crane, so the steel worker, the cops wouldn't climb up there to get the banner, so the steel workers went up and grabbed the banner, and they marched with it the next day. But anyway, because I did that banner, I didn't have anything to do the next day, because I wasn't supposed to be out of jail. I wasn't supposed to be there. So I was without portfolio, so I got to, you know, just circle the entire convention, and it was just amazing. Like, it was just a celebration of life and people power and democracy, and it was, you know, just made your, you know, brought tears to your eyes and made your hair stand up, and it was gorgeous for 3 or 4 hours till the Seattle Police Department just unleashed hell on everyone. And it was for me, it was a seminal moment in my life, and, you know, one of the greatest, you know, sort of days that, you know, I'll remember it till the day I die.
Here's a question that I'm glad somebody asked, and I'm going to address it a little bit, but I'd like to get other impressions. I wonder if you can talk about the role of indie media, IMC, which I think is the India Media Center, in WTO, and the way the movement retooled the tools and connections to Occupy in Hong Kong. I can't answer the latter part of that, but I did want to make a comment that the activists, WTO was the first time I saw activists themselves take on the role of being the media. And they were able to film and record and put on the web in real time what was happening. And this, in 1999, this was really a new thing. There were other organizations. It was the first time at Seattle Weekly, we weren't indie media in that sense, activist sense, but we put our stories on the web Tuesday night with the paper. It was supposed to come out Wednesday, and the Seattle police wouldn't let us distribute it downtown because they had locked down downtown into a you can't come in here zone, and our drivers had trouble getting in. But it was the first time we used the web for, as it happens, news. And HistoryLink, which just celebrated its anniversary, they gained fame because they put a webcam in their office window, and people all over the world could get on the internet and see what was happening without going through CNN or any of the other filters. So In some ways, after WTO, I remember the Smithsonian came to the Weekly and asked for a copy of all of our web postings for that week to put in an archive of coverage that they were collecting. So WTO was kind of an interesting media breakthrough, I think, both for the protesters and for some more mainstream outlets. And I think they played a really significant role in keeping alive parts of the story that were about what happened before the tear gas started flying. Okay, sorry to be the moderator and answer a question. Okay,
could I just add to the media question?
Yes, please.
I think another incredible technological thing that happened during WTO and has actually continued on multiple fronts was just in general the internet. Like the ability to mass communicate across large spaces and rally people. We saw that ability in WTO, but then when I think about Occupy or Black Lives Matter, in BLM, it was simply the invention of a hashtag that transformed the visibility of police brutality, not just in the United States, but across the globe. And so the ability to then organize, you know, between Ferguson and Palestine just based off of a hashtag became a very powerful global mobilizing force to talk about not just police brutality in the United States, but imperialism and militarism across the board. But we also see on the flip side of that, in Seattle, SPD uses Facebook invites or the internet now as a way of collecting the names of known activists or organizers that will be at places as a way of determining what their response is going to be to a particular protest. So I think we've also seen police be able to now use this tool that actually was incredibly useful for us in organizing as a way of also now collecting data and creating files on who does what where, and is also creating a little bit of a danger for organizers.
Lastly, and Norm, this is for you. Did the president and the governor influence the police violent response, and if so, how?
No, the president did not, the governor did not, the mayor did not. One of the things that we talk about lessons learned, WTO certainly taught a generation of police administrators and political figures and so forth to recognize the importance of establishing a decision-making jurisdiction, I guess would be the best way to put this. For years, mayors have said, well, you're the police, you handle this, because we're just talking about crowd control, that sort of thing. And I think WTO disabused a whole lot of us about that, that it is critical that decision-making jurisdictions be established and that a community government approach to policing these kinds of demonstrations is essential. I mean, if we want to continue to have fun beyond 4 hours and not gas people who are nonviolent and non-threatening, we've got to make sure that the government has addressed the issue of who's in charge here, who's really calling the shots from the establishment's point of view.
Well, please thank our panel. Let's give a big round of applause for these wonderful folks.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Baumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.